Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we'll talk about the changing nature of families, changes in our culture, and advances in technology are bringing dramatic changes in the nature of the family. Some things that seem simple are not really so simple. Questions like, what is a family? What is a legal parent? Who is the mother of a child, the woman who carries the child in her womb as a surrogate, or the woman who raises the child? What does marriage mean, and who is married? Here to help us understand the changing nature of families is our guest, Michelle Zavos, a leading attorney in family law in the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area. Michelle Zavos, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you for having me.
This is a fascinating topic, and I think it's one where we think we know what's happening or we know what the definitions are, but then once you start to really look into it, there's a whole fascinating world happening. So let's start with the nature of family itself. So how do you see the nature of family changing? You're working with families every day. What are some of the examples you see of how people are forming families today?
Well, where we've come from is when women were considered property and children were considered property. And then in the early 20th century, women became their individual selves, I guess you could say, and eventually to most extents on a par with men. Children are still considered not exactly property, but their parents speak for them, the parents decide for them. They're not independent beings. Where we've come now is, a transition time when we are redefining who is a parent. To some extent, we might even be redefining who's a child, and how we look at the family as a whole. Is it based on biology? Is it based on functionality? What are we looking at to determine who has legal rights and responsibility?
Right. And there's so much richness in what you're talking about. And we see now so many different examples of families. We have a lot more single parents, you know, women who never got married or are now divorced, raising the children. We have now legal same-sex marriage and couples. We have grandparents raising kids. So how would you define in this changing landscape, what is a parent?
Well, you know, there's a legal definition, and there might be the definition that I would prefer or that many people might prefer. The legal definition is going to differ from state to state because in the United States, most of our law regarding families is state-based. So in this area, the Washington metropolitan area, for example, there can be a difference as to somebody's legal rights and responsibilities to a child based on whether the person lives in Maryland, lives in Washington, D.C., or lives in Virginia. When I think about families, I like to think about functionality. Who is raising a child? Who's putting the child to bed? Who is taking a child to the doctor? And that may be a biological parent. It may be an aunt. It could be a grandmother. It could be a single man. There are many, many, many different flavors of families right now.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And we have the situation now also where we have rising rates of infertility and more women now with the technological advances able to maybe ask a woman to be a surrogate mother. So, you know, say it's a heterosexual couple that are dealing with infertility and they ask another woman to carry the sperm or the egg and the sperm of the married heterosexual couple.
Absolutely. I mean, what we've seen in this country as adoptions in foreign countries have really ended. Americans, it's very difficult for Americans to adopt in another country. And with the rise of technology and, as you said, the increase in infertility rates, I do a lot of this kind of work. It's called assisted reproductive technology work. Gay couples, mostly men, of course, opposite-sex couples here in the United States, and couples from other parts of the world, particularly South America and Europe, where surrogacy is illegal, come to the United States. And for some people, they have what I like to think of as a biological imperative. They really want a child who is biologically related to at least one of the parents, or maybe there's only one parent. And then those intended parents, is who we call them, will engage the services of a surrogate, almost exclusively a gestational surrogate, a woman who is not genetically related to the child she would be caring for the couple or for the individual intended parent. But again, all of these kinds of approaches depend on the state or the jurisdiction where the carrier might live or the intended parents might live. For example, in the District of Columbia, up till about, I think about 6 months ago, engaging in surrogacy was illegal. It was a felony. Mm. And now our laws have been rewritten so that we have probably the most extensive and specific statutes in probably the entire world that allow surrogacy here in D.C.
Interesting. So tell us what that model legislation is that D.C. now has about surrogacy rights.
Well, it's very specific as to what a contract must contain.
Mm-hmm.
And in D.C., it's unusual in that D.C. allows for what we call traditional surrogacy, where a woman is carrying a child who is genetically related to her. It's her own egg. So she may have been artificially inseminated with sperm and then carries a child for the intended parents. There are revocation periods similar to adoption. There are periods during which one must go into court and get a court order. But if all of those requirements of the statute are followed, then the child will be the legal child of the intended parents and not of the carrier who is giving birth.
So I remember a while ago when this issue of surrogacy first burst onto the scene in the United States, there was a couple in New Jersey that had hired a woman.
The Baby M case.
Baby M case to carry the child for them. And then after the child was born, the surrogate mother had a change of heart and said, I actually have a real bond with this child now after having carried this child in my womb for 9 months, and I don't want to give up the baby.
That child was her biological child.
So that was her egg.
Those parties engaged in traditional surrogacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that was an element, at least in that case, of a court deciding that the surrogacy would not be upheld by a court. And that case then devolved into a custody dispute between mm-hmm. the intended father, who was the biological father, and the Mary Beth Whitehead, I think was her name, who was both the biological mother and the birth mother. And custody was given to the father and his wife. But Mary Beth Whitehead retained visitation rights, as I recall. There was a similar case years later, maybe 2-3 years ago, of a gay male couple who engaged the services of one of the men's sister to be a gestational surrogate, and she gave birth to twins and had an epiphany that these were now her children. And that case as well, the New Jersey courts did not uphold the surrogacy contract. It devolved into a custody case between the carrier, who was not the biological mother, and the two men, but one of the men who was the biological father, and custody was given to the two men.
Well, with the technological advances and with the growth in kind of all the different forms of family we have now, you know, a single woman who wants to be a mother and raise a child herself, or the heterosexual couple dealing with infertility we talked about, or same-sex couples that want to have a child, there's just such kind of a thousand flowers blooming in the nature of families now.
I think it's true.
Yeah.
But it's even beyond the technological issues. For example, grandparents who are raising grandchildren, mm-hmm. perhaps because the children, the parents of the grandchildren, had drug problems and mm-hmm. have disappeared, or who have given up their parental roles or died. And then the other parent then disputes the grandparents' role in raising the children. Or two women may have a child together. They did not get married. And then they split up. And one of the women, the birth mother, says to the other woman, "You're not really a parent," and prevents her from seeing the child, a donor. Perhaps who thought he would be a parent, and then the birth mother decides, no, he's not a parent. I mean, our laws are trying to deal with all these issues, and again, every state has a different approach.
So this seems like it's really a very rapidly evolving area of law, and that there is really room for a lot of kind of misunderstanding and lawsuits and complications.
Absolutely.
So hats off to you.
No one thinks that their situation is going to become problematic. No mm-hmm. one ever thinks that. So,
right.
You know, they don't do contracts. They don't write down what their understandings are. And then when it happens, it's traumatic for everyone involved, and unfortunately these situations can bring out the worst in people.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, the bonds people have with kids are among the strongest out there, and
so
people will really fight tooth and nail for that custody right.
Well, it's also, though, I mean, for example, when our firm does a lot of kind of what might term traditional custody work, where you have a husband and wife and they're both the biological parents. I mean, we've seen custody cases that become World War III
mm-hmm.
because the parents, unfortunately, are working out their own issues in the custody case with the children.
Right. You know, they're fighting each other, and the child
right.
becomes kind of a proxy in the battle between the husband and wife.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's not just unusual forms or forms mm-hmm. that are not normative of families. It's every family this can happen.
Absolutely. So you had mentioned the case of two women not married but having a child together, and then there's a male donor who's a friend. I can totally see how that would happen. The women say, "Oh, we'd love to be parents. We need a donor." Mm-hmm. They have a friend. "Oh, I'll be happy to, you mm-hmm. know, be a donor." And then the child is born and relationships change. What legal rights are there, both for the woman who carried the child, the woman who's partnered with the woman who carried the child, and the male donor who helped out with the donation? What are the different legal rights there, or does that vary by state?
Well, yes, it absolutely varies by state. It also varies by how the child is conceived. If there is sex involved, in almost every state that I'm aware of, the father is a father. The biological father is a father. If it was artificial insemination, or also called alternative insemination, depending on the state, if a doctor did that alternative insemination, the donor most likely is not a parent. If the two women were married, the donor is most likely not a parent. The non-birth mother is a parent. If the insemination is done at home, it doesn't involve sex, depending on what kind of device is used to do the insemination, the donor may not be apparent. So people who go into these ways of parenting are really best served of seeing an attorney who is well-versed in these areas, who can say, if you do it this way, these are what the legal rights and responsibilities are going to be. If you do it that way, these are what they're going to be. And, of course, it's always helpful to write down everybody's understandings. Some of these kinds of contracts have been upheld, but for me, I recommend them to clients so that none of the parties has amnesia about what the agreements are.
Right. No, absolutely. And some of it may be amnesia, and some of it may just be unarticulated expectations. So just to follow it in that case, so if the male donor may just assume, oh, this is great, now I'll be a father to the child, whereas the two women may be thinking, oh, great, he's a donor here, but we're the parents, and we may never see him again, and that's okay.
And that's exactly right. And because people don't talk through their expectations and then write them down, everybody can have different expectations that are never articulated.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so I think we kind of may be coming to a place where, just like when two or more people come together to form a business, you absolutely want to put in writing whatever the agreement is, what's the understanding, how do we divide the work, how do we divide the profits, what happens when we break up?
It's extremely complicated because for anyone who has had a child, a child is a miracle. Mm-hmm. You know, a child's not a business.
Right.
But because of the changing nature of our families and the changing nature of technology, children are being born in ways that are different, and that they're being conceived in ways that are different. And so I think we as a society have not really caught up to how do we deal with that.
Right.
We have this legal structure that's based on biology, that's based on marriage, and then we have, I don't know what the statistics are, but so many children who are born outside of marriage that we have to figure out who are the parents, how is the kid related to all these people, and what does the law do about it?
Right, exactly. We've been talking a lot about the conception and the rights there, but there is also this question you're pointing to now, and you raise the issue of marriage. Like, what is marriage? That used to be very cut and dried. It was a man and a woman.
Yep.
Said, yes, we want to be married, had a witness, boom, it was written up, and they're married, and that was solid, till death do you part. Now, it's like not so clear.
Well, I think the marriage part, for the most part, is clear. In most states, we have formal marriage where people get married before a celebrant who is authorized by the state to marry people, whether it's civil marriage or religious marriage. I mean, even religious marriage, the rabbi or the priest has to be licensed. I don't know if that's the correct term, but has to be given the ability by the state to marry. Many states have civil celebrants, so there's no religion involved. And yes, now we have marriage equality for same-sex couples throughout the country. But we also have something called common law marriage. Very few states still have them, but in this area, the District of Columbia does. Maryland does not. Virginia does not. But there is common law marriage that is proven in D.C. really by only two elements, which is intent to be married and living together. In most other states, there's a third element, which is called publication. We don't have that in D.C. It's really an evidentiary question. But let's say you've got people who live in the district and they say to each other, we're married, and they live together, and then they have a child. Is the child a child of the marriage? Is the child then a presumptive child of both those people? How do you prove that marriage? And then let's make that even more complicated. They break up, and one of them says that the other one is not a child of the marriage, because maybe the child was conceived by technology.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets very complicated.
Wow, right. And we have had, you know, some great news in this whole area is about the advancement of human rights, and with the Supreme Court saying that same-sex couples have the right to marry. So
yes.
I you know, I just think that's it was such a great day for America when the Supreme Court handed down that decision.
Well, and actually, it's interesting because with respect to parentage, this Supreme Court has gone further. It has said that same-sex couples, for example, who are married and a child is born into their marriage, have the right to both be on a birth certificate. Up until, I think it was last year, there were some states that did not allow that, even if the parties were married. And also, the same Supreme Court has said that when married couples who are same-sex who do an adoption of a child together, meaning one of them has given birth and then the other one has done what might be called a step-parent adoption. People sometimes call it a confirmatory adoption or a second-parent adoption. But just to ensure that both parties have a legal right to that child, the Supreme Court upheld, interestingly enough, a decision from Roy Moore in Alabama that struck down one of these adoptions, but the Supreme Court upheld it. And so we have sort of those three opinions, marriage equality, the birth certificate case, and now the adoption case, that ensure, at least for same-sex couples who are married there and do a second-parent adoption, ensure their legal rights to their children.
Wow, there's a lot in what you just said there. so let's unpack some of this for our listeners. So you're saying, yes, I think it's widely known now about the decision same-sex couples have the right to marry, and that's recognized around the country. So
right. It has to be because it's a constitutional right that derives from the U.S. Constitution.
Yes, so we're good with that. And now we have the situation as same-sex couples are saying, well, yes, we want to have not only be married, want to have a child together. There's becomes questions then about who has legal parental rights. And you mentioned this idea of second parent adoption. So if you could just explain for our listeners, this is basically a legal device that was created to provide protection for same-sex couples around parental rights, right?
Right. And actually, these second parent adoptions predated marriage equality. So before same-sex couples could get married, they were raising children. I mean, they've always been raising children. And let's just take a lesbian couple where one gives birth and the other one is raising the child with her. The question is, how do you give that non-birth mother a legal right to that child? And this is also true for a gay male couple where perhaps one of them has adopted a child. So we came up with this idea of second parent adoptions, which is akin to a step parent adoption, except that the original parent does not lose her parental rights. In a step-parent adoption, say, between an opposite-sex couple, a husband and wife, maybe it's a second marriage, and the husband wants to adopt the wife's children from a previous marriage, the father, the first father, has to give up his rights or have them terminated before there can be a new father. But in second-parent adoptions, the birth mother, even though she's the same sex, does not give up her parental rights. She keeps them. And then you have a same-sex couple. Now, when marriage equality came, many people thought that marriage equality in and of itself, and having children on the birth certificate naming both parents, both people as parents, was sufficient to create a legal right, but it is not sufficient because birth certificates in our country are not a legal judgment. They are a way for the state to maintain statistics about who gets born and where and all of that. marriage itself usually will create a presumption that any child born into a marriage is a legal child of both parents. But unfortunately, there have been cases around the country with respect to same-sex couples where judges have said these two women are not able to create a child together biologically. Therefore, there will be no marital presumption that will be applied to this marriage that creates a legal relationship between the non-birth mother and the child. And so lawyers like myself throughout the country recommend to any same-sex couple to have an adoption which results in a court order that has to be given what's called full faith and credit under our U.S. Constitution by all the other states and jurisdictions in the United States. So that is an absolute, whereas the marriage is a maybe.
Right. So if there is a same-sex couple that says, yes, we want a child together, there is a child, however that child comes into being and comes into their hearts and their family, that then you would want, you know, say if it's two women, whoever the woman is that did not bear the child, I think bearing the child gives you some legal rights de facto, but the other partner would then want to adopt the child, even if the two names are on the birth certificate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the best legal advice someone can.
Wow, yeah. That's amazing. So
yeah.
Are people doing that now? Are there, and is that adoption then recognized nationally once you're doing it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I still do a lot of those. I will tell you that prior to our last presidential election, many people felt secure in their legal rights with respect to their children based on marriage equality and birth certificates. But the day after the election, I started getting calls. I need to do an adoption.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because people felt the Trump administration and the Republican ruling both houses of Congress meant there could be a tax on the rights there, and you
absolutely
can't take anything for granted.
Right, absolutely. And, of course, we've seen that there are.
Right.
So this is not something, you know, people have just made up in their heads. We're seeing it. And the safest thing anybody can do is have a court order, because court orders have to be given this thing called full faith and credit with no exception by other states.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very important tool for people to ensure their legal rights.
Right, and I like that phrase of a second parent adoption. Get that done, make a legal adoption, certify it, then you are definitely will be considered the legal parent of the child.
Absolutely. And interestingly, you know, when we talk about technological advances, the other thing we're seeing with lesbian couples, and it's similar to doing surrogacy, where one woman's egg will be implanted in the other woman. So one person will be the biological parent, the genetic parent, and the other person will be the birth parent. So then the question is, if these two people have this child and subsequently separate and then have an unfortunate dispute over who is the parent, who is the parent? I mean, there is a case like that out of California that eventually went to the California Supreme Court, which said in a very solemn-like decision that both women, the gestational mother and the carrier, the birth mother, were legal parents. And I think we're going to see that more and more. I think there's a similar case to that in Florida. And so I think we're going to see that more. But it's interesting because we had a recent case in Maryland called Siegling versus Schmidt, which involved an opposite-sex couple married, where the wife, they went to a fertility clinic, they signed all the papers consenting, you know, to this procedure. The wife was implanted with an embryo that was created by what we call donor egg and donor sperm. So the child was not genetically related to either of the parents. child is born, and then husband decides he doesn't want to be a parent.
Oh my God.
You know, he, I suppose, doesn't want to pay child support, but he doesn't want to be a parent. So,
what a time to make that decision, but
really. So he argued, Maryland has a statute that says a husband who consents to the artificial insemination of his wife is a parent to the resulting child. So
Maryland has a statute saying that?
Yes, it does. And many states have that. And the reason for that is to protect the marriage. Because, again, with high infertility rates, people are using donated sperm, for example, where the husband might be infertile.
Uh-huh.
And so you want to be sure that the husband is a legal parent to the resulting child. But so what happened in that case, it went to the Maryland Court of Appeals, which is Maryland's highest court, equivalent to a Supreme Court. And the husband was arguing that this was an embryo transfer, not artificial insemination, and therefore their situation was not covered by that particular statute. And essentially the Court of Appeals said, that's ridiculous. We have had a lot of changes in technology, and that statute covers this circumstance, and he is a father.
Yeah,
he's subject
nice try,
to all
buddy.
Legal rights and responsibilities, which include child support. So this is not, these technological advances, the ways that the law has to deal with who's a parent, is certainly not confined just to same-sex couples, not mm-hmm. by any means.
Right, exactly. Well, I'm impressed with Maryland that they're on the ball and have a statute that addresses the situation.
That particular one, yes.
Is there any state that's kind of stands out as one that has good model legislation dealing with the evolving nature of family, or is it kind of very patchworky and kind of a good law here and a good law there, but very much scattered?
Well, I think both are true. I mean, there are a number of states, California, for example, I think Maine, Delaware, the District of Columbia, maybe New Mexico. There's something called the Uniform Parentage Act, which many states have adopted or, you know, are in the process of adopting, which I think various versions of the what's called the UPA, United Parentage Act, try to approach parentage in a gender-neutral fashion. It depends how a state passes that legislation and what the wording is, because, again, this is a state-by-state determination. So, yes, we have some states that are quite progressive in how they look in, at families and how they define families. And then we have others where nothing has happened and that we're still fighting about gender neutrality, about husband and wife, when we still have marriage equality.
Interesting. And do you like this Uniform Parentage Act? Is that kind of like putting together a bunch of these laws together in a coherent way so you get the whole package passed at once?
It can be. I mean, what's good about the Uniform Parentage Act, if it were to be passed in a particular form by every state, then you would know where you are in every state. You'd know what the laws are. But we don't have that. Some states have passed part of the Parentage Act. Some have passed it with changes in some of the language. Some haven't passed any of it. So again, you do have this incredible patchwork of family law around the country. And so here in the district of Maryland and Virginia, the district has some of the most far-reaching parentage laws in the country and therefore in the world, whereas Maryland has some, but not a lot, and Virginia has a different some, but not a lot. And so it really depends where you live around here.
Yeah, it's so bizarre, really, when you put it that way. You think we're here, we're living in the same country, we're all Americans,
right.
And yet whether or not you would have parental rights to a child can come down to whether you, you know, where you live.
Absolutely, That's absolutely right. I mean, we consult with people all the time, and one of the things that we look at immediately is, and one of the questions is, where do you live? How long have you lived there? And can you move? Can we wait to do anything until 6 months have passed? Because there's another law that for 6 months, the jurisdiction where the birth mother lives has jurisdiction over parentage questions. But yes, that's something that's really, really important.
So what's the solution here? What do you think we need? I mean, it sounds to me like what we need is a really forward-looking, comprehensive family law, kind of omnibus bill passed by Congress so we have universal laws across
Congress.
The country.
Not
this kind. Yeah, we'll have to wait till we get some new blood up there. But
yeah.
Ideally, that's what we would want, right?
Well, maybe, and maybe not. I mean, for example, if you look at something like marriage equality, for many years, it was also a patchwork, state by state by state. You know, you could be married in the District of Columbia, but then your house was in Virginia and you weren't married there. You know, or you drove down to Florida, and depending what state you were in was a question of whether you were married in that state or not. Whereas if you went north, you were mostly married. But what that allowed is for states to experiment, to develop these laws, and eventually there was enough sort of bubbling up that when that final case, the Obergefell case, went to the Supreme Court. And, of course, it always depends who's on the court because
right.
it's extremely political. But when that finally went to the Supreme Court, we had many states who had marriage equality. So it was not as big a leap for the court to change that, to make it nationwide. Whereas if you have progressive ideas about parentage and you try and pass that through a Congress, you probably aren't going to get anywhere, you know. So it's an extremely complicated form of governance. I mean, for example, if you lived in France, for the most part, does not have these different approaches, state by state or province by province. There's one law, and so you know what you're looking at. Whereas here, we just don't have it. But that also allows us to be more creative. And I think the United States probably has the most creative parentage laws in the world.
Well, you know, here we are, as Justice Louis Brandeis talked about the states as the laboratories of democracy.
Exactly.
And it is the place now where this evolving nature of the changing family is being worked out on a state-by-state basis, and we'll see which laws emerge to be helpful to the really the burgeoning challenges that come up legally around the nature of family and parenting.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And we have been going, in my view, forward for quite a while. Of course, with the political situation in the United States right now, we're all worried that we're going to lose some of that progress.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, hopefully some of the states can continue to do the good work, like you mentioned, California and some of the others. And remarkably, Iowa was the first state, I think, that had the marriage equality at a state law. It was kind of like, who knew that the first country in the world that would give marriage equality nationally would be Ireland? If I were to name 50 countries that might be the first one, that would not be on the list, but there was Ireland, the first country to go make marriage equality a national law. So I think it's important, as you say, keep working on the state level to get this good legislation passed. And meanwhile, for advice to our listeners who might be involved in, you know, kind of issue a question around marriage or around parenting rights, sounds like some of the best advice you can give is to, you know, get everything in writing so people are clear on what the agreements are going into a situation. Is that right?
Well, I would say the very best advice is to go see a lawyer who knows this yeah. area very well. I mean, a lot of my clients come in and say, well, I looked on the internet and I saw this and that, and I say, forget the internet, please. Mm-hmm. Because again, because our country is, our laws are state by state, somebody might be looking at somebody something on the internet where people are talking about California, which has absolutely nothing to do with Maryland. So the first thing really is to see a lawyer, and a lawyer can help create these kinds of contracts. I know people don't like to spend money, but this is something that, you know, is going to have an impact on the rest of your life, and so you really should try and get it right.
Exactly, and even this question about jurisdiction and technology, you know, if you're doing insemination or, you know, how it's being done can affect the legal rights of the people involved. That's something that a lawyer would know, you know, what are the different elements that you might not even think about.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I just got a call today from a potential client about a potential parentage case. And, you know, I'm not going to talk about the facts of the case, but she had been to see three different lawyers who all told her there's nothing she can do about this particular situation. And as soon as I heard the facts on the case, I said, those lawyers are wrong. Here's what we can do. Here's why we can do it. Totally different advice than what she had heard before, and that's because the other lawyers do not know this area of the law. And so they hear the facts of a case like this, and they automatically assume, well, there's no marriage, there's no biology, so there's nothing we can do. And that's just really far from the truth.
Interesting. What would you say is the greatest challenge you have faced in helping families?
I think the hardest thing is when someone is functioning as a parent, and they've been functioning as a parent, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, meaning the child has lived with them, they're taking the child to the doctor, they're going to the school conferences, all of that, but there is no legal right for them to be a parent. And those are heartbreaking, because then the other parent, let's just say it's grandparents and a child has died and they're grandchildren, and the grandparents have been raising the grandchildren with the other party's permission. Mm-hmm. Maybe not explicit, there's nothing in writing, but it's implicit. And then the other party all of a sudden decides, no, you're not going to have this child anymore. Those cases are heartbreaking because litigation is expensive. Proving sort of parental functionality is difficult. Again, it depends on where you live. And I just think that's such a bad thing for a child. I mean, we're really trying to look at the child's perspective here. In the child's mind, who's my parent? Mm-hmm. The person who's taking care of me and hugging me and singing me songs. And, you know, it's just like an adoptive situation where adoptive parents have become parents through a court order. They're not biologically related to the child, but they function as parents. And what allows them to be parents, legal parents, is the court order. But so many people are in those circumstances, but they don't have any court order.
Wow, that must be heartbreaking.
It is. It is. It is when you can't help people.
Amazing.
So I would think those, for me, those are the hardest cases. You know, somebody comes in to me ahead of time and says, so this person and I want to have a child together. What's the best way to ensure that we're both legal parents? That's a relatively easy case. But it's the after the fact, when the child has been in a certain form of family for 2, 3, 4 years. And then there's trauma, and you have to try and figure out, how do we ensure that that child has a continuing relationship to the people who have functioned as parents?
Right, and you talk about the adoptive parents, and I am an adoptive parent. Yes, we have the legal right to be the parents through a court order, and we also are functioning as parents. I mean, we right. are. There's no difference between an adoptive parent and a biological parent in terms of, you say, hugging the child, reading to them at night, making mm-hmm. sure they're getting good nutrition and medical care. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we do. So,
absolutely. Like, you know, it goes back to how do you define a parent?
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is just a biological parent, and, I mean, I've had these cases, say, where maybe it's been a one-night stand, and then 4 or 5 years later, the biological father comes back and says, I want the child. That person has never paid a penny in child support, maybe has never even seen the child. How do you consider him a parent?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and would a biological father have any rights in that situation?
Yes.
Oh, my
yes.
God.
Yes, he does. He does. Again, it depends where you live.
Mm-hmm.
But potentially, yes. Absolutely. So let's say you've got a situation, and I've had these cases, where a woman gives birth, it was a one-night stand, biological father knows about the child, disappears, never comes back, mother now gets married, and they want to do a step-parent adoption. And mm-hmm. all of a sudden, biological father shows up and contests that adoption. Generally, we will win those cases, but, you know, it's not easy.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've done a number of cases like that. And, I mean, what's horrible is I think we all know how that case should resolve, but we still have to go through all the steps. You know, there has to be litigation. The father may come in to court and contest it. It costs a lot of money. So, yeah, it's very difficult. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned earlier in the conversation about kind of biological parents, but even that term can be complicated. So if
well, right. I mean, the biological part is right, but it's not a parent. You know, so how do you...
Right.
We need some new terminology there.
Mm-hmm.
The biological creator. You know, I don't know. But, you know, the same thing happens in foster care situations where a child has been taken from a situation because of abuse and neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And the biological mother, the biological father, still have rights to that child until a court changes the goal of the foster care situation from what's called reunification to permanency planning, which would be an adoption or guardianship. And, you know, I've represented cases. I've represented adoptive parents or foster parents in foster care systems and cases where the biological creator, parent, has been given chance after chance mm-hmm. after chance to reunite with the child. And meanwhile, the child has bonded with the foster parents, considers them the parents, and then all of a sudden you pull the child, say, after 4 years, into back with the biological mother. I mean, what are we thinking?
Exactly. Well, and I think it goes back in part to what you said earlier about the evolving nature of rights here in family law, where, you know, before it used to be women and children were property of the man,
right.
the father, the husband, but that's kind of evolved over time, and at least now there's some consideration given to the best interests of the child.
That's right.
So it's not just property. So we can at least introduce that into the picture and into the argument.
Yeah,
you know,
I think we're going in the right direction. For me, it's not fast enough.
Not fast enough.
Because I think more and more parentage needs to be seen from the child's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get functionality as a parent. It's how does the child consider? I mean, if you have a 2 or 3 year old, that person, that child can't articulate why, you know, so-and-so is my parent. So you have to look at the functionality to determine, oh, yes, this person really is functioning as a parent to this particular child.
Right. So if you were in charge, is that kind of the single biggest change you would make, is to make functionality kind of the key to parentage?
I think I would. The problem, you know, people joke about how, well, then the nanny is the parent some of these parents who have three nannies to work with them and all of that. And, of course, in my mind, I'm always wondering, why do these people have children in the first place? But, sure, functionality, it has to be functionality plus somehow.
Right.
You're not getting paid for it, for example.
Yeah, okay, so it's not a fee-for-service situation.
It's not exactly.
You're doing it for, you know, because of the love in your heart for it.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, that's great. And what's the most heartwarming case you've had where you kind of worked on a situation and you just felt so good afterward? It was like, justice is done and this is great for the child or great for the situation. Is there something positive that you, an experience you've had like that?
I would say, you know, again, going to the same spot of functionality where two women had a child together, not married, no legal rights for the non-birth mother, but she was awarded visitation over the other mother's objection. So she had a she got to have a continuing relationship with her child. So that's the kind of thing that is terrific. I mean, for example, in I will not represent biological mothers or birth mothers who are keeping a non-birth mother away from a child. I will certainly do a custody fight, but I will not argue that the other person is not a parent.
Yeah, so make it a custody case, not a parental rights case.
Exactly, exactly. Yep.
That sounds like a fair way to do it. And do we have any, like, real champions? Like, who's out there that's really saying, here's what needs to happen around families and marriage and children and parenting?
Well, there's a distinction between, say, the theoreticians and the academicians, and we're very fortunate here to have Nancy Polakoff, who is a professor at the Washington College of Law at American University, who's been writing on these issues for 30 years. And then there are the people who are practitioners, you know, like myself, and there are lawyers like me all over the country who are doing this kind of work and sort of trying to keep pushing the envelope of how we define parents so that children can have continuing relationships with the people they consider to be their parents.
And is there an association of lawyers working on family law?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a group called the National Center for Lesbian Rights, where many, 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 many years ago, NCLR would represent women who were coming out of marriages who were being denied access to their children. And, that's morphed over, I don't know, 30 years or so, to NCLR really, I think, being the leading organization for looking at functionality of parents. And the legal director for NCLR, a man named Shannon Minter, who is just an incredible advocate in these circumstances, and Kate Kendall, who's the executive director. I think because that obviously is an organization that really works on lesbian and transgender rights, but the reason that type of an organization is so important is because same-sex couples can't be biological parents together. So we have to develop new legal theories about how these people can both be parents to a child. You don't have to do that in a traditional marriage. So that's part of what is, I think, pushing the envelope here.
Interesting. And how can listeners learn more about your work?
Oh, they can go to my website, or they can just look me up, and I'll come up. Last name is, you said Zavos, Z-A-V-O-S. We practice in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., and the name of our firm is the Zavis Junker Law Group. My law partner, Eva Junker, does a lot of our litigation on these kinds of cases.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate all the great work you're doing with your head, your heart, your legal skills, your wisdom, your caring for the children, your caring for the couples and the families. Thank you for helping everybody navigate through this really fascinating changing waters that we're swimming in regarding the nature of families.
Well, thank you. It's very nice of you to say that.
That's all the time we have. Michelle Zavos, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your great work for families. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.